Death of our son Steve, we have found that a parent is always a parent. And there, someone told me that people who are married, certainly they're married and in love, and Mary and I thought about losing one another, but people, that does happen, and other things come into people's lives and mitigate that, and in a sense are replaced but not replaced. And I've talked to Doug considerably about that, Doug Sparks. But the fact is that you always are a parent, and you always have a parent's heart. And it doesn't matter what age people are. The fact is you still care, you still worry, and you're still anxious about what is happening with your children. And there are some of you who are single, but you have relatives, you have friends. Ruth Knutson has been with us and has really lifted the load for Mary through this time, and has a close, deep relationship with our children and grieves with us. But one thing we have to remember, you see, is that you don't just have one child, you have four, or we do. And so it's easy in parenting adult children to only to go to where the wound is and to ignore the others. And we can't do that. There's a life to be lived and to go on. Now, as we think about parenting adult children, we'd like to divide this into two rather distinct periods, though they're probably not that distinct. One is the period from 16 to 22 years of age, where a person is sometimes a teen, sometimes an adult, sometimes a child, and you never know which, because they go back and forth, and you won't know from one moment to the next. But the fact is they are young adults, and they deserve to be treated that way, and we must be prepared to treat them that way. We cannot treat them as children, and we cannot treat them really as teenagers. So the focus of what we're going to talk about is not the adolescent problems, which I think is a whole other issue, but how do you make them into good adults? And then we'll go into the independent anxiety of ages 22 to 30. When all those new experiences invade their lives, marriage, children, jobs, loss of jobs, and one thing and another that come into their lives. And through all of these, where are the parents? Well, the parents are worrying, interfering, praying, talking, regretting, wondering why Psalm 127:1 doesn't work. Is that the right verse? That's not the right verse. Proverbs
22:6.
Train up a child in the way he should go, and he's old, he'll not depart from it. Wondering why that doesn't work. And they expected something different than actually happens. Now, I'd like to read a couple quotes from one of the sources that we used in this, and there were very few sources we found. And the best exercise that I can give to you as parents of adult children to help you relate to your kids is to ask you to reflect on those years of your own life. Now, I know that's a long way back for some, but just remember, just briefly, the conflicts and the fears and the fantasies and the feelings of awkwardness and the uncertainty. Remember the peer pressures and the guilt of giving into temptation, and the discovery of your sexual self and your first loves and the first heartbreaks. Remember how it felt to commit sin and to struggle with it, and your feelings toward your parents, which probably exist even today, and toward your brothers and toward your sisters. And relive some of the memories of your anger and your hurts and your embarrassments and your loneliness. But also remember the times of what made you feel good, and the successes and the achievements and the loving and being loved and the secrets you never told your parents. How many of you got secrets that you've never told your parents to this day? Yeah, most of us do. And so do your kids. See, there's a world that's different. If you happen to be sexually experienced before you were married, remember the inner struggles and the guilt. and even the elation of the experience. And then bring back some of the memory of the resulted from those, the struggles that resulted from those sexual decisions, or experience, your experience with drugs or alcohol, or your thoughts about suicide. Because most have had them. It's just that many do not act them out. Now, when I ask you to do that, those memories are not pleasant. And most of us in our Christian lives have learned to block those memories, see? But they come back in the middle of the night when we wake, like we do every night. It seems about 3 a.m. And all kinds of things flood in. Or when insecurity starts to set in on your own life and your own position, your own contribution. And take time, maybe, to, as a parent, to write out a few of those struggles and the major events and your feelings in your late teens and your early 20s. You see, one part of us desperately wants to protect our children from experiencing what we experienced. And another part says, you got to learn. But you see, it's impossible. Our world is not their world. The world has changed and their environment is different. They don't live on a farm and walk 2 miles to school in a blizzard and carry newspapers for $1 a week or experience any of those legendary hardships that we did. Our past can never be their present. And that's hard for us to come to grips with. This is a seminar not on how to help your kids, though it is in a way, but it's to help you help yourself to help your kids. They had conflict and they had inner turmoil and their arguments and misunderstandings that you remember. I think back into times with Steve and all of our children. Some of the conflicts, fortunately, Mary and I can say in the last 5 years, there was nothing that was unresolved between us and Steve. And that is a blessing, because believe me, there were temptations to do so. We never know what the future will mind. Now, you might try to understand them. Last night as Christy called, I said, "Hon, I feel so badly for you. I know I don't understand what you're going through right now. And I can't understand the feelings of loneliness that you feel right now, but I can pray for you." And I think a key word for our young adults is the word feelings, not thinking. And if you can keep that in mind as we pursue this time together, it will help you. Because we tend to be cognitive people. I think that's the right word. That is, we want to think things through. And if you happen to be an engineer like I am, you really want to line it out. It doesn't help. It doesn't help Mary. She said, "Would you stop talking to me like that?" And so we need to somehow realize that they're different. I have a quote from Susan Litwin of the Postponed Generation, talking about the generation that is becoming adults right now, your kids. Says they set a great store by having a stylish place to live. This is not a generation of pioneers. They are just kids with a high sense of entitlement and not a high sense of reality. She also went on to say, in some work that was done by the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research, that they are increasingly goalless and anxious. The crises they face is a part of their special history. They were raised in the 60s, when we were all greening and changing in various ways, and best of all, knew that we could afford to do so and believed that our children would be able to do so. If we never told them that life could be tough, it was because we had forgotten it ourselves. It would turn out that the expectations they grew up with weren't going to work, at least not in reality. But they lived on in fantasy, since the fantasies were so much nicer than the reality. And it was reality that had to go. They lament that jobs are in the cities, or they leave entry-level jobs because the company didn't implement their ideas immediately. It's hard enough to establish an adult identity, even in the best of times. But to do it with such a jarring conflict between expectations and reality is a stunning task. I'd like Mary to just go ahead and share a little bit now on just some of the biblical background that we're going to use. And we aren't going to use a lot of Bible. I don't want to pretend that the Bible says this, this, and this when it doesn't. Much of this is our experience that we're going through with our children. But there is a lot of scripture in it, too. I'll come back to the goal.
Okay. None of us really likes change. We find a comfortable niche for ourselves, and then to change is difficult. But as our children grow, we need to be changing our mindset, the way we think about our children, the way they are operating and behaving, and the way we're going to relate to them. We all come from their infancy from a point of controlling our children. And this is good. We control them because they need it for their own protection. They need it for their own sustenance. They can do nothing for themselves. But it's hard to let go of the idea of control. And after a while, it becomes the idea of control is more for our own peace of mind and our own comfort zone than for their development. And so we just need to start preparing early on, even well before the age of 16, that we are not in a controlling mode of our children. And that's very hard to do, because if we could just from our point of wisdom say to them, if you'll do this, things will go well in your life. But that isn't the way God operates with us. He gives us free choice, and he gives us suggestions, but then the free choice to follow his commands to us. And if we don't, we know there will be results. The same thing will happen to our children, and it's to their benefit to try and to fail and to move out on their own without our complete control. And I think this little illustration tells it quite well. But Mom, I've been grounded for 32 years. Well, there are times we'd like to do that with our children. We'd like to just ground them indefinitely, but it doesn't work. Irma Bombeck, who isn't really one of our doctrinal sources, but sometimes she has some pretty good ideas, and she addressed this issue of our children leaving home and trying to release them. And she says, if it's true that life begins when the kids are grown and the dog dies, then why do parents have all that wisdom left over? You'd think at the end of 20 years of child raising, we'd come out even, but we don't. We're tempted to run down the aisle at their wedding screaming, wait, I'm not finished with you yet. We're upset because we've gone from being a supervisor to being a spectator. It's like being vice president of the United States. We have so much we want to tell them. We want to share that the number of checks left in a checkbook does not always coincide with the amount of money in the account. And we want to tell them that federal taxes are not really an option. The emptiness does hit us very hard. Once we were the center stage in their lives, and now we look out and the audience has left the theater. And for those of us whose children have grown, we feel like that, don't we, sometimes? The audience is gone and we no longer have anyone listening to us. Well, why is it that we don't want to let go? Why do we keep clinging and holding them in a closed fist? From the time they're infants, we hear that we're working ourselves out of a job. And in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, as Jerry has said, we don't want to let them go. And once a parent, always a parent. And there are ways in which we relate to them and yet ways in which we must let them go. Some things that make us cling are family history. We've watched them grow up. We know what type of personality they have, and we can see the risks in some of the things they do. And so we want to hold on and say, you must do this, you must do that, and give directives instead of counsel. We fear for them. Sometimes we want to live vicariously through them. We've made mistakes, or there have been things missing in our own lives that we'd like to see happen with our children. So we hang on thinking perhaps we can maneuver their lives so these things take place. And I think a big one for many of us is just a lack of trust that God will deal righteously and justly and in mercy with them. And we want to help them avoid those deep things that will cause them to grow, just so that they don't have to suffer. And so we don't place our trust as fully in the Lord as we should and allow Him to deal with our children. And sometimes it's helpful to just to think of our relationships with our adult children and to see if they have those ingredients of mature adult relationships, or if it is still a controlling situation. Mature relationships have a lot of respect. Do you respect your children? Do I respect mine? What they can teach me? What they are doing with their lives? Mature relationships have privacy and freedom. Do I feel the obligation to know everything that's going on in their lives? Friendship, encouragement. Have we in the last week or two offered something of encouragement to our adult children? Certainly courtesy. And sometimes there's a breakdown of this during the adolescent years. Well, it needs to be restored and brought back into full play. And just a sense of caring for them, even when it can't be overt. And of course, as we pray for our other adult friends, we pray for our children. So all of these things, a little checklist, are these aspects present with our adult children?
What do you do when they're not courteous to you?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yep. This is interactive,
well,
you know.
We do, we'll talk about this perhaps in a little while, but there is a point where we say, I am unwilling to accept any more of this rudeness or this discourtesy, and it will have to stop. We can't communicate. We just will have to leave each other alone for a while. I think Dobson maybe was the one who came out with the tough love idea. And we have seen this in action. In fact, in one of our extended family situations, the tough love took the form of actually removing one of the children from the home because it was destroying the rest of the family. And so it can't be accepted as norm, and well, it's a phase that they're going through. They don't need to anticipate rudeness or discourtesy from us, but neither do we from them. And now there's a difference between that and direct confrontation, of which we've had quite a bit in our family, but done in a way that is not destructive and terribly hurtful.
It's one thing we'll probably want to discuss is with basically good kids, they're doing fine, but you see something happening in their lives, and you see it leading to an area that's not too good. Do you ever tell them? Or do you wait till you're asked? But for that, let's go to the goal. The goal that we have, and it's written in your notes, is that our overall goal for our sons and daughters is that they grow into mature, independent, godly adults who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, who will face good and difficult times with calmness and perseverance, and who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents. Now, note that there are only a couple things that are, quote, spiritual in there. That applies to both Christian and non-Christian alike. I don't know anybody who does not want to raise children that have this balance. And so one of the purposes in our time together is, how do you major on the majors and not major on the minors? And this, we believe, are the majors. But in order to do that, somehow, as I indicated earlier, we have to prepare ourselves in our minds. And so what is it that you do to prepare yourself to be a different parent than you were earlier? So, Mary.
One thing is to have a real strength in your relationship as a couple. And it's very difficult in the midst of a hard situation to do a lot of remedial work in that area. So just to keep that growing and strong as you go along, to pray together. And Jerry and I have found that this is one of the hardest things to do just time-wise. It's not hard to pray together. That's a joy.
If you'd stay awake later at night, it'd be easier.
And if you would get up a little earlier.
That's our problem right there in a nutshell.
I've always tried to explain to Jerry that it's biblical to be up early because Jesus arose a great while before dawn and went out to pray. But Jerry somehow has skipped over that.
I like to start and wait for the dawn.
But just to have that communication and that strength as a couple. And then when the difficult times come, to be able to support and encourage one another. Two are better than one, as Ecclesiastes tell us, that we can rejoice together in the good times. And sometimes they come together, don't they? If you have more than one child in your family, there can be a deep sadness or grief over one situation and a joy in another. Steve has been gone 7 weeks, and our daughter, one of our daughters, is about 7 weeks pregnant. So there's a great joy, but there's a sadness. And so we can be together in these kinds of situations. And to be very careful that we don't assess blame on one another for some of the difficulties that our children go through. That we're in a support mode rather than a blaming mode. And the flip side of that is that we do not take credit for their success. You know, God is in control of their lives. And one day I was talking with a mother and sharing with her a difficulty that one of our children was going through and asking her to be in prayer. And when we were finished, she said to me, she has the same number of children we do, and by the way, we still have 4 children. One is just in a different point of eternity than we are. Shouldn't have said that. But she as well had 4 children, and she said, you know, our kids are doing so well, we must have done something right. And I thought, let's give praise to the Lord where it belongs. Because once they're making their own decisions, it's the Lord who is going to lead and guide. And if we are privileged to come in with a bit of counsel and so on, that is helpful. But it's the Lord, the God of hope, that we rely on for our children's future. We want to be available and attentive and very sensitive to parents who are, as singles, trying to relate with their adult children. And those of us who are couples and strong in our relationship can look for opportunities to come alongside single parents and give them a hand in this area. Very important that we keep growing spiritually, and I know we know this so well, but there are times when we don't have time to back up and get prepared for situations. Jerry and I have said often since Steve died that we're so grateful for the scripture we memorized and wish we'd memorized 10 times more, because the Lord uses it in difficult times. And then to have a support group. Probably most of you are in little Bible studies or something, but they may be ones that require a lot from you that are draining rather than building up and supporting. And to have that kind of friendship available, whether your children are going through difficult times or not, but just to have this group behind you with whom you can share, call on for prayer, and allow them to observe us as we go through difficult times. And it's an upbuilding thing in the body of Christ.
One of the hardest things to do in raising adult children who are independent is to let them go. How many of you know of parents who are always clinging to their kids, trying to run their lives? Some of you probably experienced that with your own parents. Mary and I have not. Our parents wonderfully let us go. Now, letting go is not dropping the children from a 10-story building or shoving them out into the cold without a coat, but it's a gradual release, an ever-increasing freedom. The problem is timing. If you ever see Mary throw a baseball, you have an absolute illustration of the problem of timing. Someone shared with us once that, and I compare Mary, she's like the cross-eyed discus thrower. Says they do a great job throwing the discus, but just keep that audience out in the stands really awake, because you never know where it's going to go. And of course, any of you throw a ball, you know that you've got to release it at exactly the moment in time. That's the problem of raising adult children, is when do you really let go of what? And usually, parents are too late with too little. They fled, and as Ann Lander said, we haven't said goodbye. So we would like to share the illustration that you have in your notes, but just to picture what we feel to be the process of developing them. That first of all, you have this time of control which Mary described. Diapers, food, and you tie their shoes and you keep them safe and they love it. They hug you and they cry when you're not there and to control all their comforts. But by age 10 and 12, that's gone. Probably by age 7 for many. Then you move into a time of coaching. Now coaching is where you send in plays. Helping Kathy make her first cake. Now, this is dumb for me to be talking about this, but here I am. I mean, no, here Mary is. Helping Kathy make her first cake. Well, you do this, and then you do this, and then you put in this ingredient, and then you stir this, and then you coach. You tell them, but they have to do everything. Or I remember the first driving lesson with Steve. We had an old black Volkswagen with a stick shift, and the whole family gathered on the front yard and laughed as he jerked down the street. I mean, what a deal. But everybody, it's a memory. But you see, you just coach them. You send in the plays, and they're carrying them out. Now, the tendency is to control and say, oh, listen, you loused it up. Let me do it again. Let me show you how it's really supposed to be done. Because you can do it better. You can do almost everything better than your kids. You can think better. You can do sports better at a certain point. You can cook better. Or if you say to a daughter and saying, here, listen, how in the world are you ever going to feed a family if you don't learn to cook better than what you do? Etc. You see, we have to help them by coaching. And it's tragic, though, when even the coaching goes on too long. That coaching, if you'll notice, the coaching begins right back at age 0. And the sooner you can move to coaching rather than control, the better off you are. But then it starts to tail off, and you get into counseling. It's not telling them what to do, but it's simply counseling them as they ask. And that's the problem of counsel. You've got so much to give, and there are so few questions asked. And they want to ask others, generally not you. What great words when they say, Dad, can you give me some advice? But they've got to ask. Only rarely, and in times of extreme need, do you offer unasked for counsel. And then you finally get to that which encompasses all of it, caring, loving. They have to know that beyond everything else, you're the one refuge besides God that they have in this life. And they really do care.
One of the things that happens to many of us in this era of life is that we have parents who are becoming enfeebled and dependent on us. And this illustration is going back down the other way with our parents. So while we're trying to release in one direction, we're having to control in another. And that's very difficult to do. But our adult children are watching us. And what they see us doing with our parents is the pattern that they will follow when we are older. And it's interesting that in the scripture, everyone is taught to honor their father and mother. Children are to obey, but we're all to honor, no matter what our age. And a demonstration of that to our adult children is very important for their future patterns in life.
Now, what your goal, of course, is independence, healthy independence. And there are three areas of independence that you want to move them to. We feel there's spiritual independence, functional independence, and emotional independence. Let me just say a word or two about spiritual independence. There's much that could be said on this. And you and I really think we really want to emphasize this more than anything else, because this is what's so big in our minds. But I need to warn you that you can't force this spiritual independence. Now, remember the goal said that we want them to grow into mature, independent, godly adults. A good illustration, which I won't spend much time on, is the illustration of Joseph. Joseph was very young when he was taken into captivity. And Joseph in the Old Testament had only what he had been taught before to become spiritually independent and to make decisions on his own. So you have to think, what if you were totally cut off? Would they make independent decisions? Well, there are several factors that will help us. First of all, there are many doubts that they never verbalize to you. Does God really exist? Is the Bible really the scriptures? Prayer doesn't seem very real to me. I prayed and nothing happened. And why can't I go to that movie? Why can't I watch that video? Why is premarital sex wrong? I'm not sure I see that in the Bible. But see, the fact is that most of those they don't express to you. I have a little handout. If I didn't make it up, I should get it. I have about 10 questions. Remember that one, Mel, that we did? 10 questions that teens always ask but never ask. And one of them is the existence of God. Believe me, they go through it. You know, is Jesus really the only way? Do I have to believe all the Bible? And see, the reason they don't ask us is it disturbs us. And they want to be kind to us. They don't want to disturb us. But not hearing them should distract us more, because those questions are there. They really are there. Now, if you're one of the rare people that all your kids have just grown up and given no problems and just love God and are walking with God today in the way that you would like to, which may not be the way God would like them to, then you're very fortunate. But also you have only God to thank for it. Now let's take one particular issue, the existence of God or the truth of the Bible. There's a process of four stages that the kids go through. Usually it's recognizing that they have a question. They recognize the issue. Then there comes the rejection or partial rejection of their parents' belief. That almost always will occur. They may never tell you. Then there comes a time of re-evaluation and then a rekindling or an alteration of their beliefs. Steve's a good point. About 8 years ago, Steve took us to lunch at the Hungry Farmer and said that he just couldn't believe quite like we believed and was really questioning. one year ago on June 3rd, we as a family went out for a little drive. It was my birthday. It isn't the 3rd, but I was going to be gone as usual on my birthday. And it was one of those Colorado cold days, snow and everything in June. So everybody bagged out on the trip except Steve. He said, no, let's go. And he talked the entire way. But one thing he said on the way was that I am reevaluating everything about my beliefs now. And I'm coming back. I'm going to take the leap of faith back to God. Now, of course, that's a very precious memory to us. And we just drove up there a couple days ago with the whole family again on my birthday. And to remember that Steve was coming back to this. And Julie shared, she said, when we shared Christ with her last December in significant detail, I said, oh, Steve will come full around again. Now, Steve also said, Dan, I may not be an evangelical like you are and be able to go to this church and that and do, but I'll have to make it my own. That's at age 30. Now, what I want to say is that it takes maybe years, but in almost every area spiritually, they will go through this. And let me share with you what I believe we need to have as far as their spiritual independence is concerned. Now, I'll go through this kind of fast. This can be available to you later. First is the beliefs need to be truly their own, not yours. They cannot adopt beliefs. Secondly, we need to confirm with them and help them see that the Bible is the source of all truth and their belief and conduct. And then we need to help them search out for themselves the answers, not to give answers. And that isn't easy because we've got all the answers, we think, until certain things happen in our own lives. Then we have very few answers. And then we need to really help them, in spite of all that goes on in their lives, to develop a pattern of some daily time of reading the scriptures, even when they're rejecting it. Help them to seek out other believers and to teach them to pray to God that God will give them guidance. If you will notice, most of the areas about which you have conflict with your adult children are not on that list. Isn't that interesting? But yet, those are the most important things to them. See, you want to have roots in their lives, not the external obedience. And also note that others will have more influence on their life than you do. There will be others who will help determine most of their beliefs. And one of the things we need to avoid is a stifling legalism, which we will always tend toward. And the last thing to mention here is we need to learn to discuss issues in a non-threatening way. Just say, I don't know. Say, you know, you may be right. Because your best teaching tool is the example of your life, not the words of your mouth or the thinking of your mind.
We also want them to be emotionally and functionally independent. We're close to a couple, and the wife came to us not long ago and she said, my husband is not emotionally independent. He is 40 years old and he is still waiting for affirmation from his father. She said he'll never get it just because of the personality of his father. This is an extended Christian family. And so we want them to be able to release those ties to us emotionally, even while we still stay close. And there, I think, are some ways that we can do that. And this can start no matter what their age, of course. And that's to express confidence and trust in them. And sometimes that's difficult to do because we see them making mistakes. But even when they do, we can say, well, you know, you probably learned some things, and I really think you're going to do so well in the future. Always something we can praise them for. And then to release them to make their own decisions. And this is often hard to do. If we see what might be a left turn on their part. But unless sin is involved, once they're independent, to let them make their own decisions and allow decisions that don't meet with our approval, but which aren't going to be totally devastating. I remember when Jerry was teaching at the Air Force Academy, and cadets would come to him and say, well, what kind of car do you think I should buy? And Jerry would give some practical answer, and in a few days they'd come roaring up in some sports car that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And then 2 years later they'd come back having traded that in and got a secondhand station wagon with a wife and a child and a dog. So, you know, but that kind of decision is not going to ruin their life. They're going to learn, but it's not a devastating decision. And then to really encourage a broad set of relationships rather than tying them closely to us or the inner family circle, especially in the Christian community. And there are ways that we can foster that, but we won't take time to share all that. And just to release them to their own personal responsibility. If they make mistakes, they need to be held accountable for that, not to always move in and to rescue them, to allow them to struggle and fail, and again, to resist the temptation to always rescue. And those things do help foster some of their own emotional independence and separateness from us. And especially for those who are still teens and in the home, just to help them be functionally independent so that by the time they leave the house, they should be able to feed, clothe, and house themselves without turning to us for assistance all the time, to be able to handle their own finances. And Ron Blue and Larry Burkett have produced some excellent things in this area. I was visiting our daughter at CSU last year, and we were riding along, and a little car ahead of us had a bumper sticker that said, "I love Daddy's money." And I thought, yeah, you know, we've seen that with some of our children, but they need to have the independence where they can train themselves to use the resources they have, even though they're very limited. Again, Christy told me about a girl on her floor at the dorm who took off on a one-week spring vacation and ran up $800 on the credit card her father had given her. And he just paid it off, and that was that. But that didn't teach her much about financial independence. And for some kids, this is harder than others. And just to kind of help them and keep their toes to the fire in this area so that they will develop their own independence.
I think we'd like to stop here. Normally, the way I'd like to do this is just if we have a group of 15 to 20, you normally can't get through even one little section with about six hands going up. Now, you're a very kind group. I can understand that. But I think we ought to stop and just for a question or two, and maybe you, some things have come to your mind in the areas of independence. And before we go on with the last part of this.
Yeah. Let them stand up and sit down.
You think they need to stand?
I do.
I think they're doing good.
Do you want to just stand up and sit back down?
Yeah, yeah. Stand up. There it is.
Kind of a
good
long
idea.
Session here.
Yeah. Okay, and if there is a question just while you're standing, why don't you just go to the mic? Yeah, can you use that mic right there?
Okay, have a seat.
Yeah, jump up and down, get the... That wasn't long enough. If you wanted to have exercise, yeah, do what Roy is doing.
On or off.
That's it. Okay.
Question.
It's not on.
Question I have.
They're going to turn it on here in just a minute. Let's see if we can get that machine on. Go ahead and talk. We'll go ahead.
Letting go of your children. You mentioned the problem of the normal problem of usually parents letting go too late. But what about letting go too early? Can you comment on that?
I have rarely seen it, except with parents. I have seen it with parents who are very irresponsible. In other words, they just want their own freedom. And now that is going to be a pattern in the baby boomers. You know, with they'll want to let go and to get rid of them. I rarely see it with conscientious parents. But I think it's something that you may want to include in your thinking. It's unlikely, for instance, that coming to a seminar like this, you will get many people who were that as the problem, but I think it needs to be addressed. Now, some ways that you could let go too early is to expect too much of them too quickly. And we may think we're letting go, but what we're really doing is setting them up for failure in terms of pushing them out into things that they're not ready for. And we may think pushing is letting go, but it isn't. That there's a big difference between pushing them to achievement and letting go of them, allowing them to find themselves and to being able to coach them along the way. Yeah, Bob?
Another comment on the area of confrontation and stopping the discussion in the midst when real communication is not happening. What thoughts do you have on reinstituting the communication responsibility of parent or child or timing and that kind of thing?
I think sometimes the communication really breaks down because we know our children so well and we're giving the answer before they've been allowed to express themselves. And we're not really hearing, at least this has been a problem in our home, that when they start to make a suggestion or they start to express what they're thinking, that we leap in with the answer instead of saying, well, explain that a little more, I'm really interested. And a lot of discourtesy, if this is what you're talking about, comes from frustration on both sides when we feel we aren't heard. And just learning new ways, even to sit down with an adult child or a youngster and saying, we don't communicate well, and let's stop and think, what are you about the way I talk with you so that I can learn how to change that? And so sometimes just getting it out in the open and talking about it helps.
I agree with Mary that most often we don't listen. And I know I have a tendency to interrupt, to give the answer before I've heard the question, and to override their thinking. Now, as far as when do you reinstitute, I believe it's mostly our responsibility. The reason for not reinstituting in anything or getting restitution amongst Christians is pride. Almost universally, it's ego and pride. And our pride, I get so ticked off sometimes. And I just say, well, boy. And then I get to thinking, wait a minute now. Who is supposed to be the mature adult in this thing? Me. And so that I think often we will need to initiate. That doesn't mean you say, well, listen, I'm sorry I was wrong. You may have been. But you may want to say, you know, I just don't feel things are right yet, and can we talk? And to open that door for recommunication again. Now, they may not allow it to be open. For one thing, most of us have so many patterns from the past that it's very hard to break those. And I would say one of the key things you and I need to do is to recognize our own bad patterns, to admit them and break them and to reinstitute the relationship with our kids.
James says that we should be, James 1:19, quick to listen and slow to speak. But often we reverse that and we're the other way around. And I think it was Dear Abby that said, the less we speak, the more we're listened to. And so if we really give a listening first, then we've earned a right to speak.
Nancy?
I wonder if you would just address the situation where the children are still at home, you are financially responsible for them, but their adult children may be commuting to school. And then in that situation, how much input and control should you still have on their life as far as are you going to go to church or not? Are you, what kind of friends and so on, when you're still bearing the responsibility financially?
And we've had that situation. Let me start, and then you can pick up a little. I think that, first of all, it is your home, and that certain things should or should not go on in your home. For instance, you may decide that certain kinds of music and alcohol and so forth ought not to be in your home. But you've got to make it clear that that isn't saying, you know, you have to make the decisions on your own life. But the environment of our home is ours. Now, in terms of going to church and so forth, I think it's a losing battle. If by the time they're 18 they don't want to, You can try and get them on guilt trips. You can do all kinds of stuff. But basically, it's an issue of their own independence and discovery. Now, just one other thing, Nance, for just a second. I think there need to be clearly understood rules and a financial arrangement in terms of how they conduct themselves, in terms of being in the home as adults, and this is particularly so as they may return later. Now, we're going to talk more about that on Boomerang Children later, but, hon, do you have some other comment? Or, Nancy,
no,
you had a further question.
Just one thing, in adding to what you were saying, we don't, fortunately, have this problem right now, but I've heard so many Christian, particularly fathers, make the comment, as long as you're in my home, you're going to go to church. And I just, I think we need to be agents to help change that.
Right. I don't think that'll work. And I don't think it's worthwhile. I mean, going to church is not a mark of spirituality. It's a mark of legalism.
But it makes us look better at church than our kids come.
Yeah, it's an issue of our own pride and ego. Where are your kids? Any of you ever been embarrassed to take your kids to church? They sure are embarrassed to have me go some places with them. Joyce, can you use the... Would you please bring helper with the mic? We just need it so it's on the tape.
Okay. About your goal, you've stated this as a goal. I don't mean to sound argumentative.
Oh, please.
Thinking about what Larry Crabb has taught us in the past, I changed the word goal to desire for some of these things because I have no
Good
control
idea.
Over them.
Yeah.
And my personal goal can be to be Christ-like with them, as you're saying.
Right.
And to provide the atmosphere in which these things may occur. But if I make it my goal, I'll be guilty when they don't happen.
That's a good observation, especially in terms of Crabb's differentiation between desire and goal. For those who have not heard Crabb, you then have to describe it as to what it is. And that's true. Yes.
I really have two questions, but I'll just ask one and then give someone else a turn. You mentioned that they always have doubts and questions that you don't ever hear.
Right.
Do you ever approach them about these or try to draw them out?
Yes, I think you should. I think you need to give the... And I'm not sure we did all that well on it. Okay, but you know, I'm too soon old and too late smart or whatever it is, that saying, that I think it's good to say, you know, we've had some doubts and I've wrestled through this. And they'll give you clues. And our usual thing is to ignore them. I can remember things my kids have said. Well, for instance, I remember one night, one of my daughters was very disturbed one evening. We were kind of laying in bed there and talking. She said, what if the other people are right? In other words, what if we're not right on this matter of knowing Christ and knowing God? She said, what if the other people are right? Now, and fortunately, I didn't just put that one down. We talked that one through and continued for a couple, 3 years on it. But that was a question of saying, what if it's all not true? So that's a good point. Yeah, Don? Then I think we'll go on and then we'll come back and have some more questions.
Jerry, you had indicated earlier that we need to help our kids have a daily time with the Lord.
Right.
Maybe even during periods of rejection.
Right.
Give us some insight as to how to do that.
Pray like crazy. I don't know that we've done all that well, but some have done better in having personal devotions with their kids than others. That's one way. Your pattern is very clear. Now, many of them have a stereotype or have no stereotype. In other words, they don't even know what it is to have a quiet time. My main purpose is to help them to read your Bible daily and pray. Just the good old 2-7 quiet time. Just say, as little as it may be, just to do a little of that. And if you can get the habit ingrained, you'll be surprised how through difficult times they'll turn back to that. Because that was one thing that they knew to do. Do you have any other thought on it?
I think, as Jerry has said, the example is the important thing. And then as others come into their lives, if we can generate relationships with others who demonstrate this as well, that helps.
Good.
But it has to be their own initiation, their own pattern.
Okay.
I think so, yes. I think one of the hard things now is the speed at which our culture lives. And trying to get the family together even a few times a week, as we have a Bible study group, and we call them our young couples, and they're all around 40, but becomes kind of relative here. But they live at such a pace that they're seldom together around a common time, whether that be a meal time or an evening. And so it becomes difficult, and you really have to encourage families to work at that, just to establish that pattern.
Okay, we're going to take about another 10 minutes, and this is what happens in this, is you tend to expand out, and that's just life. And that's why three sessions is probably more ideal for this particular topic. But we'd like to talk a little bit about one of the most important things in their lives, that is training them to make good decisions. And then the second thing that we'd like to talk about is influence. So right now, and this is all part of being independent, could you just make a few comments, brief though they may be, on communication?
Let's see, is that a good way to communicate?
Sure, effective. I may live with it for days, but right now it works.
This will be very brief, and of course we've all been to many sessions on communicating, but just thinking in terms of our adult children, of course to listen, as we have just said. Make sure we understand what they are saying. Remember, they're in a process of growth and flux, and what they said a year ago may not be what they're thinking and saying now, so to listen very carefully, to really anticipate disagreements, because these will come. They are living in a different culture than we are living in, and there are lots of things to disagree about, but we have to decide, now, is this just a personal preference of mine, or is this really a spiritual priority to get all hot and bothered about and to start arguing about? Steve was very politically different than we are. And we had some very interesting discussions with him, but not divisive ones. And now we're finding in talking with Julie that some of these same things crop up, but they're preferences. They're not priorities for the life. And as we've already said, to really try to curtail our advice unless it's asked for. And it's very sweet to hear, hey, I really need some counsel in this. But that doesn't come when the counsel is always forthcoming without the request. And to avoid ridicule. Especially during those teen years, because there really is a lot that holds itself up for ridicule and funny comments, but it's so unproductive and it's unbiblical, and I guess you'd even say sinful, and it just destroys communication right away, because none of us would subject ourselves to that, and neither will our children. And then, as we've said, just to refuse verbal abuse from them. We don't have to take that, and it can become sin in the way that they talk with us or we with them, and we need to keep very short accounts there. And perhaps one of the most crucial is to protect their confidences. Do they know if they come to us, whether they're 13 or 30 or 40, that we are not going to run around telling the whole earth? And that's why when we share some of the problems our children may be having, it would be quite discreet in the sense that we wouldn't describe which one. And there are a lot of things our kids go through that we simply would not share with anyone because they're telling us about it and they don't expect to have it spread all over the Navigator world or wherever. So be careful to protect their confidence.
Real question on making decisions is what makes a person make certain kinds of decisions. I mean, how do you make decisions? And I'd like to share with you what I think the primary six things that help, that cause people to make decisions. And it's you. You think of yourself now in this first, and then make it to them. The first is the parent's example. No matter how much you may not like what your parents did, I'll bet you make most decisions like your parents did. The second thing is the personality and the intellectual ability of the individual is so determinative on how they make decisions. Then Mary is going to talk in a moment about styles of thinking. That is the way that a person thinks Do you and your husband or wife think alike? No, there are different ways of thinking, and Mary will address that. Then the spiritual vitality will determine a great deal of how they make their decisions, whether they're walking with God or not. Education and training certainly make a difference. You know, a person who has gone, for instance, through 4 or 5 years of college will make decisions in a different way because they view the world differently than a person who dropped out of high school at the ninth grade. It's not always true, but often it's the case. And so what their education and background is, and then their peer influence, the way their friends make decisions causes them to make decisions. Now, those that are asterisked are the only ones that we can influence. See, the only ones we can influence is our example, spiritual vitality, and their education and training. But 2, 3, you know, the personality and intellectual ability, styles of thinking, and peer influence is totally outside of our control. Almost totally. And you just simply have to recognize it. But Mary has done some work on the way people think. And I'd like her to share that because it will help you understand your own children.
This, too, will be very brief. There have been a lot of scientific studies done, and maybe some of you have read some of these things, on the styles and the way in which people process information and reach decisions. The right brain, the left brain, all of these things blend in. But just to help us basically as parents, we all have different ways that we approach the information and the experiences that we have. Some people are analytical. I think Jerry is an analytical thinker. He takes information from here and gets all of the information, draws it together, and makes a decision. Some people are intuitive thinkers. We have at least one daughter who's an intuitive thinker. She just sort of responds. And oftentimes God gives intuitive thinkers the gift of discernment, I think. Maybe Helene Asker. You know, people of that style of thinking. Well, you put an analytical thinker and an intuitive thinker together, and they have a little ways to travel before they come together and realize where the other's coming from. Creative thinkers, people who like to have ideas and come from the point of ideas rather than processing. Logical thinkers, these are somewhat like analytical thinkers, but logical thinkers have 10 steps to go through, and if you take step 1 and 2 and then jump to 8 and 9, they're all confused. They like to know the process. And you may have some kids like this who question everything that you do, wondering how you reach the point where you are now. Visionary thinkers, something like creative thinkers. Bill Bright's probably a visionary. And the Lord uses that, but if you are a logical thinker living with a visionary, you think the person is half crazy. And so if we can determine what type of thinking we do, and then there are combinations of these, and as I say, this is greatly watered down, but if we can decide how our children think and process what's going on, then it helps us when we're trying to communicate with them and understand where they are and where they're going.
Now, I notice in our notes that we don't have a section on this, but I'd like to just share with you on training and coaching decision-making. I think there are several things that we need to do to train and coach. The best thing you can do is to... Is this on, or did I lose it? It's on?
Off.
Off. Did I jerk it from somewhere here? Is it on now?
Yeah.
Okay, I jerked it. Okay, is to analyze yourself. Have your husband or wife help analyze what kind of a thinker you are. And it's not right or wrong, it's just what is. Then help them see how they think. One parent says, if I had known these different patterns, I could have saved so much conflict with my children. And then involve them in the process of decisions that you're making. Allow them to fail and help them to discern long-term and short-term effects of decision-making. Now remember that one of the goal, and perhaps desire would be a good word there, but it's to help them predict and understand the future consequences of present decisions and to learn to sacrifice present pleasure for future fulfillment. To me, those are the two great marks of maturity. That they understand that present decisions have future consequences. And you know the difficulty of young people thinking through what might be down the road. And the other thing is to have delayed gratification. Those are the two great marks of maturity. And it would be good if we could help them come to understand those. But that will not happen overnight.
Jerry?
Yes. Sure. Now, the one is written in your notes. See, this one on the goals is written in your notes. Okay, Mary, on influence.
Once our children reach adulthood, our main input into their lives will be influence, and that of other people as well. We've given you a number of references, and we would like to say that Revelation 15 doesn't have a 20th verse, so if you would change that to Proverbs, please. Proverbs 13, 20, which says, "He who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm." And these other references as well speak of the power of influence. 1 Corinthians 15:33, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good morals," or good character, whichever translation you have. And so the influence of others as well as ourselves is going to be very important, and you see that as they go through the teen years and you watch them develop relationships in their high school or with their classmates or with their peers. And we spend much time in prayer that they will pick the right ones and not come under the influence of bad peers. As parents, we influence by example. Our moral example, our ethical example. Do they watch us exceeding the speed limit or talking in derogatory terms about the government taxes or whatever? Our relational example, do they see us reaching out, extending ourselves to other people, and then receiving love and care from others as well? So they're going to be watching that all along. Our character, do they watch what they see just in our basic character and how that will influence them? Spiritual influence. And one of our daughters said, "It was so helpful to me when Steve died that you turned to the Word." Well, you know, we've turned to the Word over years, but we never know what situation will impact on them so that there is a consistency. And then there are many times, I know many of you feel the same way, when you can influence in no other way than prayer. And we prayed for our children since they were conceived, but somehow it seems to have speeded up as they've become independent. I don't know if you feel that way yourself, because that in many ways is the only influence that you can have in their lives. And then the influence of others. And we have seen this happen with each of our children, and we feel it's so important for them to develop at least one mentor outside of their parents who will be a strong spiritual and ethical influence in their life, and just a friend. We just had a recent example of this. Can I take time for a tour? Our youngest daughter really took her brother's death very hard. They were close. They were very much alike in their personalities and in the way they viewed the world. They look alike. And she said, "My sisters each have a husband, but I don't have anyone, and he was my someone." Well, for the last several years, we had a couple in our Bible study, Ed and Marilee. And last year, Ed and Marilee moved to Hong Kong, where Ed is in business and doing very well. Christy, several years ago, had asked Marilee to disciple her. She was about 16 at the time, Christy was. And sometimes it seemed to us that it was more giggles and laughs than a lot of what we would consider hardcore discipling. But their relationship was so close, and they prayed together and talked about things. When Steve died, Marilee called from Hong Kong and said, "Now, I want to come for the memorial service. I want to be there for you." But she said, "I think it would be better, since there's so much activity and hubbub, if I just sent you a ticket and you come to Hong Kong." So 2 weeks after Steve died, Christy, who's never traveled internationally, hopped on an airplane, went to Hong Kong, and spent 10 days with Marilee. While she was there, she had a lot of personal time and influence on Marilee's 13-year-old daughter, Reagan. And Marilee's just beginning to feel now Reagan's growth into these adolescent years and some diminishing in their communication. So it's generational. We were able to share with the Turleys, and they with Christy, and now Christy with their children. And the Lord uses that kind of system or relationship or whatever you want to call it. We've seen it happen in Kathy's life. And then others who have come in for Steve and Karen as well, where they are free to, where our children are free to talk with them about things that they don't want to speak with us about, and yet it is still a strong spiritual influence for them. Just to remember not to try to intrude on this relationship, to try as parents to manipulate or undermine in any way, because it is so important. And not to envy it, because it is a gift from the Lord that He is bringing both into our lives and into the lives of our children.
Well, you can see that there's just lots to think about in this area of parenting adult children. I think the one thing we would see is that most of our adult children don't realize that life is hard. Now, certain events bring things to pass that make them see that. Certainly our son Steve's death has done that. But in the main, they think life's going to be pretty easy. And it simply isn't. And we know it isn't. And we need to help them come into this life, which is not easy, to be able to face it with real godliness, if they are walking with God, but with good judgment. And that good judgment comes the same way it came for us. A lot of bad experience. And we don't like that for our kids. But they've got to do it. And we've got to let them go through it and love them going through that, and not to control them. Let's take 3 or 4 minutes just for some questions on the topic, and then we'll move into some questions on conducting the seminar.